is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Yaqui on Culture and Race, Part 7. An article that appeared in the Financial Times just a few days ago caught my eye. It was titled, "The Closer We Look, the Less Superior Humans Are." And it goes to Yaqui's revulsion at the idea that man is comparable to an animal in any way. He saw man as fundamentally different and incomparable. The Financial Times writes, "The more closely scientists look at other species, both extant and extinct, the less remarkable our own becomes. Nearly everything we once thought made us human does not. This sobering message is reflected in Yuval Noah Harari's bestseller, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, which provocatively challenges the concept of human uniqueness. Homo sapiens is unique only in the literal sense that every other member of the genus Homo died out." And if you're wondering, as I was, based on that name of the author, Yuval Noah Harari, yes, he's a Jew, he's an Israeli. And I think the takeaway from this, and the reason I add it to this podcast about Yaqui, is that it's not rationalists pushing this relativism, this equation or equating of humans and animals. It's Jews. Now we're going to return to where we started with Yaqui. Where I started was the section late in his book that he titled Cultural Vitalism. And after realizing what he was talking about, that he had laid the groundwork earlier in his book, we covered in the last few installments here those earlier expressed thoughts, because they really do lay the foundation for what he goes on to talk about here in this later part of the book. But here we are back at page 248. And recall that Yaqui regarded spirit and soul as paramount and preeminent over biology and materialism. Page 248. "If two individuals widely separated geographically and in no contact with one another develop similar inventions, similar philosophies, choose the same subject matter for drama or lyric, this is not, quote, influence, unquote, or nor coincidence, but a reflection of the development of the culture, capital C, to which both belong." This is his typical style of argument, just asserting the spirit over the material, because the alternative is that it's actually the material, that there is a material connection there, the DNA of these two hypothetical people who have no contact with each other. I prefer to believe it's what they do have in common, the genetic material that they share, that would lead to a similar springing forth of ideas or the culture, rather than some mysterious spirit which is intangible and unknowable ultimately. The idea of emancipation, as an example. Where did it come from? Who created that idea? And who, more important, who drove it once it was created? Who drove it to the point of emancipating the Jews and emancipating the Negroes and emancipating women to the point we're at today, where we're emancipating transsexuals, people who are psychotic? Yaqui continues, "The nature of the unity of the culture is purely spiritual in its origin. The material unity that follows is the unfolding of the precedent inner spiritual unity. Life is the actualizing of the possible. The development of a high culture is the unfolding over the predetermined organic lifespan of the inner possibilities contained in the culture soul. Again, he's asserting the primacy of culture and saying that the material follows from that. And I think that's an inversion of the reality of the situation. And he really doesn't mince any words there. He says it's purely spiritual. He's not saying it's any type of mix. This is not fact. It's belief. It's his belief. On page 251, skipping ahead a bit here, he writes, "The intensity of the impression of the culture on individuals is proportional to their receptivity to spiritual impressions. The individual of small soul and limited horizon lives for himself because he understands nothing else. To such a man, Western music is merely an alternate up and down, loud and soft. Philosophy is mere words. History is a collection of fairy tales, even the reality of which is not inwardly felt. Politics is the selfishness of the great. Military conscription, a burden which his lack of moral courage forces him to accept. Thus, even his individualism is a mere denial of anything higher and not an affirming of his own soul. The extraordinary man is the one who puts something else before his own life and security." Well, I would agree with that final sentence there, that point. But I would disagree with this imaginary concept of soul that he talks about. It's fine as a metaphor, but I think it's rooted in the biology. That's my own bias that I bring, contrary to Yaki, who believes the opposite. Case in point, this receptivity to spiritual impressions that he talks about, where does it come from in his argument? He doesn't explain. He doesn't argue where it comes from. I would say it comes from biology. It comes from the genes. It's a heritable trait to be receptive, to be open-minded, to be personality traits in general are heritable. Now, Yaki divided people, the people he was concerned about, into two main classes, the masses and the culture bearers. We're going to move now into this part of his analysis. Yaki regarded spirit... Oh, this is actually me now, just trying to explain what he's getting at here. Yaki regarded spirit and soul as paramount. Thus, his emphasis on the Western culture and Western civilization rather than the European people. He was a classic right-winger, illiberal, and had no problem in favoring and having a view that favored inequality and hierarchy over the liberal ideas of equality, egalitarian, the egalitarian idea of liberalism. Page 253, he writes, "In earlier centuries, the common man did not attend the cultural drama. It did not interest him, and the participants were not yet under the rationalistic spell, the, quote, counting mania, unquote, as Nietzsche called it. Counting mania referring to democracy, voting. In earlier centuries, there was no suggestion anywhere that the masses of the population had a part to play. When this idea does triumph, it turns out that the only role these masses can play is the passive one of unwieldy building material for the articulate part of the population." This is where he gets more specific about the distinction. "There is in all culture a spiritual level of the entire population called the culture-bearing stratum. It is this articulation of culture populations alone which makes the expression of a high culture possible. It is the technic of living, the habitus of the culture. The culture-bearing stratum is the custodian of the wealth of expression forms of the culture. To it belong all the creators in the domains of religion, philosophy, science, music, literature, the arts of form, mathematics, politics, techniques, and war, as well as the non-creators who fully understand themselves, experience the developments and themselves experience the developments of in this higher world, the appreciators, he calls them. So within itself, the culture-bearing stratum is articulated into creators and appreciators. It is, in general, the latter who transmit the great creations downward, insofar as this is possible. This process serves to recruit the higher material, wherever it appears, into the culture-bearing stratum. The process of replenishment is continually going on, for the culture-bearing stratum is not hereditary in any strict sense. The culture-bearing stratum is a purely spiritual level of the populace of the culture. It has no economic, political, social, or other hallmark. So here he is just flatly denying that there is any hereditary component whatsoever, that it's purely spiritual. But this renewal that's going on sounds an awful lot like organic life. In fact, as I pointed out before, he uses the metaphors and the words that he selects are meant to inspire that way of thinking about it. He's actually stealing the idea of life from real life and assigning it to spirit instead, which works as a metaphor, but he does it so consistently. And here you can see he actually describes culture as if it's the real deal. It's the thing with agency, with awareness, with a goal, with teleological direction that it's heading in of its own volition. And that the people, these culture bearers, are just bearing it. They're just the way through which culture expresses itself. It's a captivating idea if you could go along with him, if you could ignore the fact and the reality of biology as he was able to convince himself to do. But I don't see it that way. He could have called them the culture creating stratum rather than the culture bearing stratum, is my point here. But then that would be to admit that the spirit and the culture actually springs from the material rather than vice versa, as he wanted to see it. Within this stratum, this is on page 255, skipping ahead again a little bit. Within this stratum, there is constant struggle between tradition, with a capital T, and innovation, with a capital I. The strong, vital part naturally represents the new forward development, affirming the next age. It is the function of tradition to assure continuity. That would be true, in a healthy culture, I think his description there of those two components of a healthy culture. But as we can see nowadays, the tradition, or at least anything that's associated with white European traditionally, is something to be deconstructed, denigrated, desecrated, defiled, and it is to our discontinuity that this is happening, in the whether it's causing that discontinuity or it's just a consequence of it is up for debate, but that's the reality of the situation today, many decades after Yaki was writing. Page 256. The culture-bearing stratum, articulated into creators and appreciators, is invisible as such. It corresponds to no economic class, no social class, no nobility, no aristocracy, no occupation. Its members are not all public figures by any means. But by its existence, this stratum actualizes a high culture on this earth. If a process had existed by which members of the stratum could all be selected, the extra-European forces, Russia and the United States, and perhaps he's referring there to the Jews as well, would probably have exterminated it in the attempt to destroy the West. The attempt would not have succeeded, for this stratum is produced by the culture, and after a long period of chaos, a generation or two, depending on the circumstances, this cultural organ would have been again present, including in its numbers, descendants of the invaders, who would also succumb to the idea, capital I. Now here he makes a point. That's a consequence of his way of seeing it. He asserts that the culture is what is primal, and that the people are just the way that the culture expresses itself. The material is how it expresses itself. And so he has the advantage here of having a fairly optimistic view of Europe and his idea, more about that in a second, that it will somehow prevail no matter who actually occupies the land of Europe. I'm not at all that kind of an optimist. I would like to be an optimist and think that Europe will rise again. Europeans will once again assert themselves and throw off the invaders, recognize what's happening, and stand up for themselves and defend themselves. But the reality is that if they don't, Europe and Europeans will be destroyed, and any ideas, anything associated with Europeans will be destroyed as well. That's the reality of seeing that biology is actually what culture and spirit spring from, as opposed to the opposite. Time will settle that disagreement. I hope it's settled in favor of Yaki, but you know, it brings up the question that comes up again and again when, say, racial nationalists debate with civic nationalists is, why should I care what's going on in this patch of land that I used to think of as my country, my nation, if it's occupied by aliens? Even if they speak my language, even if they go through the motions of practicing what I see as my culture, why should I care? I can't bring myself to care. About Yaki's idea, what he called the idea, as I've pointed out before, he's kind of vague on it, but it is basically the thesis of his book, Imperium, this idea of a unified Europe. To recall again, back on page 64, he described it as not being able to be summed up in a catchword. It can't be explained to an alien, he says, but it already exists in all Westerners, although it's only in a few, the culture bearers. The alien will understand it as little as he has always understood Western creations and Western codes. In other words, very little. Here he's acknowledging that it is the people that are important, that it's this idea will not just express itself no matter what people it's carried by. Page 116, he describes it as the idea of the unity of the West against the nationalism of the 19th century. This is his horizontal versus vertical. This is 19th century nationalism, which he deplores and prefers this 20th century idea that he's promoting, this unity of the West. Back to where we're at later in the book here, page 257, he writes, the notion of mere prominence must be dissociated strongly from the idea of belonging to this stratum, describing again who is part of this culture-bearing stratum and that it's not hereditary. It's not based on any class or nobility or anything like that. The notion of prominence is related to the idea of the culture-bearing stratum in this way. Every man who is prominent in any field and who also has inner gifts of vision, appreciation, or creativeness naturally belongs to this stratum. The culture-bearing stratum has its highest importance now rather than in previous centuries because it is a relatively tinier minority. The tension can be suggested in figures. There are not more than 250,000 souls in Europe who constitute, by their potentialities, their imperative, their gifts, their existence, the culture-bearing stratum of the West. Their geographical distribution has never been entirely uniform. And he goes on to make the point that it's moved from this place to that place all over Europe over time, which he doesn't really explain how spirit explains that, but I would admit that it's, if spirit is what's doing it, then I guess spirit doesn't have to explain it because it's spirit, right? It's intangible, unexplainable why spirit moves from one place to another. It's harder to explain biologically unless, of course, you consider the effects of the parasite, the Jews. then it makes much more sense why certain areas of Europe flourished at certain times and why other areas were devastated by wars and conflict. But Yaki doesn't really focus on that materialistic biological consideration, competition. The articulation of the culture has three aspects: the idea itself, the transmitting stratum, those to whom it is transmitted. The latter comprise the vast numbers of human beings who possess any refinement whatever, who maintain a certain standard of honor or morality, who take care of their property, who have self-respect and respect the rights of others, who aspire to improve themselves and their situation instead of pulling down those who have enriched their inner life and raised themselves in the world. They are the body of the culture vis-a-vis the culture-bearing stratum as its brain and the idea as its soul. So this is not even the masses he's talking about here. It's really just the culture bearers and the people just below them that actually are the body of the culture, as he describes it, these other people who have any measure of refinement, whatever. Now, beneath them, he says, but beneath all this is the stratum totally incapable of cultural attainment, even the most modest. The mob, canal, and this is interesting, his long list, I'll read the list and then I'll get in, dig into the, what the words actually mean. Canal, pobl, underworld, profanum vulgus, the common man of the American cult. Now, some of these words I had never read before, so I went and I looked some of them up. It was amazing how many different words he came up with for the same concept of this class he's trying to describe. The mob sets the tone and gives you a hint as to what he's talking about. Canal is from the Latin canis, which means dog, and it is described, it's defined as rabble, riffraff, proletarian. Pobl, I'm guessing an umlaut is missing over the O, because the word pobl is how I think it's pronounced in Swedish or German, also means rabble, mob, riffraff. The profanum vulgus is Latin, and it means the common herd. So all of these words are just synonyms, but it's amazing to me that Yaki knew all of these synonyms for the same concept. He despised that class so much that he knew several different names for it. They preside at every terror, he wrote, capital T terror, referring to the wake of the French Revolution, bloodletting and violence, violent death that the resistors of the revolution were subjected to. These preside at every terror, listen wishfully to every Bolshevik agitator, secrete venom at the sight of any manifestation of culture or superiority. As soon as a creative man makes his resolve and proceeds with his work, somewhere else is in a dark, envious soul there resides a crooked determination to stop him, to smash the work. In his later years, the nihilist Tolstoy gave perfect expression to this basic fact with his formula that not even one stone should be put atop another. The slogan of the Bolshevik in 1918 was also illuminating, quote, destroy everything, unquote. In our age, this underworld is in the possession of the class warriors, the rear guard of rationalism. It is thus working, from the larger political viewpoint, solely for the extra-European forces. Previous rebellions of this stratum were all doomed because of the unity of the culture, the pristine vigor of the creative impulses, and the lack of external danger of such crushing proportions as exists in this age. Its history is not yet over with. Asia has use for this stratum and plans for it. That could very well be a reference to the Jews, although he might have more broadly meant Asia in the sense of India and China as well, and even the Eurasian idea, Russia being the westernmost part of Asia. I looked up Tolstoy to find out what he was getting at there, what Yaki was talking about, and found out that Tolstoy, the famous Russian author, had gone through a bout in his life with nihilism. He around about 1878, call it 1880. At the age of 50, Tolstoy achieved everything he had desired from life: a famous novelist, happily married with six loving children, and the owner of a 16,500-acre estate. He should have been supremely happy. Just before he turned 50, Tolstoy experienced moments of perplexity and an arrest of life when two questions began to recur oftener and oftener. What is it for? What does it lead to? At first, the questions seemed stupid, simple, childish, but soon he became convinced they were the most important and profound of all life's questions. Unlike few of us, Tolstoy had fulfilled his every desire, and he had nothing left to wish for. He no longer could close his eyes to avoid seeing that nothing lie ahead of him but suffering and death, complete annihilation. He beheld that he believed, what he believed was the fundamental truth of human existence. Life is meaningless. That is nihilism. My reaction upon reading this, and especially in light of what Yaki has been writing, is that, yes, life is ultimately meaningless from the point of view of an individualist, an egoist, someone absorbed in themselves and their own limits, their own insignificance, their own mortality. But this isn't the case for those who see themselves as part of a tribe, as part of a nation, as part of a race. And even, I have to admit, for humanists, for someone who sees themselves as part of this thing called the human race, those people all have something in common that the individualist, the egoist, doesn't have. They see something beyond, something greater than themselves, something that they're part of, but which is less small, less finite than themselves, something that's potentially immortal. That's a fundamental difference between the people who see themselves as part of a group whose identity is tied to that group, and the person who imagines that they're alone